From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the developer of downtown Sacramento's rail yards explains why they were months late in paying property taxes. Plus, the new StoryCorps book, all about mothers. You'll meet a Sacramento woman who tells the story of an unusual career change her mother made. And a local quartet with the violinist who won this year's Classical Jammies Award for Young Musicians. But first, nearly 200 California schools are officially flagged persistently lowest achieving. Three are in Sacramento County, about a dozen others are in adjacent counties. What does it mean to be persistently lowest achieving? What options do the schools have? And what will happen if they don't improve? We have a variety of guests. We'll start with Deb Sigmund, who's Deputy Superintendent at the California Department of Education. Deb, welcome.
Thank you.
What does it mean that a school is among, quote, the persistently lowest achieving?
Well, generally, it means that they have not satisfactorily improved with regard to the accountability measures that we use in the state of California.
So
that
examples would be.
So that means not moving students far enough along in terms of the assessments that we give. So not enough students are proficient by California standards. So most of the schools, if not all of the schools, ended up with having low percentages of students who were proficient on the California assessments that we give to students.
Is this intended to, well, what is the goal of publicizing this list?
Well, I think that it's probably multifaceted, but certainly we provided the list in response to a federal grant opportunity, as well as some state statutes that were recently enacted. And it gives schools the opportunity to apply for some money to actually implement some reform efforts to help turn their schools around.
Deb Sigmund of the California Department of Education. Also with us, Jonathan Raymond, superintendent of the Sacramento City Unified School District. One of the district's schools, Oak Ridge Elementary, is on this list of persistently lowest achieving schools. Jonathan, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How did you react when you learned that one of your district schools, Oak Ridge Elementary, is on the statewide list of persistently lowest achieving?
It's not a list that you want to be on, but you know, let's be honest, we have many challenging schools in our school district, and so Oak Ridge, you know, it's clearly one that's had significant challenges. You know, they've been working hard at addressing those challenges, but by these state indicators and federal indicators, it hasn't been doing the job for our kids, and so we view it as an opportunity to not only to make some changes and to build on the work that's been done, but really to accelerate. So it's a place where our children are being prepared to have futures in careers as well as going on to college. And that's the approach that we're taking.
Give us a snapshot of Oak Ridge Elementary. What kind of school is it? And why is it not doing as well as it could?
It's in the heart of Oak Park, which is a very, very high poverty community. It's had a lot of challenges. It's been in program improvement for several years. Certainly less than half of its children are reading on grade level as well as performing math on grade level. It's had low scores by federal as well as state standards, AYP, adequate yearly progress, as well as its academic performance indicators. You know, these are the accountability measures that the state and the federal government uses. So, you know, but again, that just tells part of the story. And again, I think that what we're looking at is making sure that all the children in the school, you know, have an opportunity to go on and to have really successful lives. And you know, you'll hear from one of those students here shortly. And, you know, we think there's a lot that can be done and that needs to be done at Oak Ridge, as well as five other schools, which we have designated as superintendent priority schools.
That's a separate initiative within the district. That's not part of the California Department of Education's official list of persistently lowest achieving schools. You've identified five others also
that's
need help.
Correct. That's correct. And, you know, I mean, I want to be clear that, you know, I mean, this isn't all about Oak Ridge in our school district. I mean, certainly it is a school that has challenges, but we believe there are a number of other schools that have challenges. And, you know, whether they meet the department's criteria or not, you know, we believe that there's opportunities that have to be addressed at these other schools. And as I've said, it's not about putting the blame on people in the community or the hardworking staff that's in these schools, but it's about an opportunity to continue to do some things differently and build on some of the models of success that have been tried.
Jonathan Raymond, superintendent of the Sacramento City School District. Also with us, Jamae Wilson and Juliana Fuentes. Jamae is a tutor and volunteer at Oak Ridge Elementary, and Juliana is a sixth grader there. Jamae, Juliana, welcome.
Thank you for having us. I've been working with Juliana for about 7 months now, and I've seen a lot of improvement just on the school's campus. So.
When you say working with Juliana, meaning what?
We meet at least once a week on Tuesday mornings just to get together and go over various different items, from school activities to her actual homework to just talking about what's going on with her home life and what's going on campus. And I'm just more of a mentor for her every week.
Juliana, you and Jamae co-wrote a letter to Superintendent Raymond last month about your fears of what might happen to the school. Specifically, what are you worried about?
That we should keep the...
Go ahead.
Do you want to read what you wrote? Just a little bit. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Although I will be graduating from Oak Ridge Elementary School this spring, I feel that the younger students that I have made with the will be very saddened by the loss of the school that had become like a second home to us. These children will not like only to their teachers for the education, guidance, and love that they need every day, but also to the beloved that contrarily principal Mr. Lewis, the kind staff office that moderately cafeteria ladies, and the helpful volunteers that continually take time out of their business busy schedules to show these kids just how important they are.
I just need to step in here, Juliana. Thank you so much. We need to put some context, add some context to what you just said about the principal, Jonathan Raymond. Is there a risk that the principal of the school could be gone?
You know, again, the department has given us four options to pursue. One is closing the school. The second is closing it and turning it over to a charter organization. And I have explicitly said those are two options that I'm not interested in pursuing. I don't want to close the school. It's an important part of this community. And I'm not interested in turning it over to a charter organization. We had one down the street at Father Keith B. Kenney, and that was a failed charter. That we've taken back that school, and that school is struggling as a result of what I think was a long series of neglect by the organization that was running that school. So the remaining two options are to replace the principal as well as certain members or certain percentages of the staff, and to look at reconstituting or transforming the school. So those are options that we are going to pursue. And we're being thoughtful. We're visiting with staff. We've met with the parents and other members of the community. We're conducting interviews one-on-one as well as with the group. So we're being real thoughtful about what's the appropriate approach.
Jamae Wilson is a tutor and volunteer. Do you have reason to fear that the principal could be gone or that the school could be closed? Or are you just worried that it might happen?
Right now, I'm just worried that it might happen. There is definitely a fear that Mr. Lewis will be gone, which it's resonating very loudly in the community because there are a lot of community partners that Mr. Lewis has brought to the school to help build morale in the students. It is a big deal for the students to want to be at school, which in turn, it's showing up on their test grades. If students are missing school because they're not feeling well or they can't make it to school or they don't have enough food to eat, that is a big deal. So what a lot of our community partners has done is just to help give these kids an equal start. Equal Start is the nonprofit that we work for, just to be able to get them to school and get them in class and get them to stay there. And Mr. Lewis, he has been such a great big deal in getting that together.
Deb Sigmund at the California Department of Education, talk a bit more about these various options that are presented to the schools that are on this persistently lowest achieving list. Superintendent Raymond just said two of those options he's not interested in.
Right.
Where does the department stand on those options?
Well, the options are actually options that are required based on receipt of monies, the school improvement grant, which is a federal grant opportunity. So the U.S. Department of Education actually defines what those models are, and Superintendent Raymond described them accurately. There's the school closure, which basically one would close a school and transfer those children to other schools, higher performing schools. restart, which would restart, as indicated, under a charter organization or an education management organization. And then the remaining two, again, would have to replace the principal and up to 50% of the staff, increase instructional time to other various things that would improve the performance at that school.
Who decides which of those models actually happen at the given schools?
Right.
Is that the department? Is it the school?
No, it's the district. So for Sacramento City, that's a decision that they'll make with input, obviously, from their community and their staff. So the design of the grant is that we want to make sure that the community has some input as well.
Jonathan Raymond, one of the options under this law is school closure. You said you weren't interested in that. But as I understand, Sacramento City School District, like many districts, is looking at the fact that it might have too many premises and is looking to close some down. Wouldn't this be a way to get federal money or state money to help that process along?
Well, again, close the school down and you know, apply for monies for what? You know, to put kids on buses to send them to another school. We don't think that's a good option, particularly for this community. We're looking at our facilities and we're looking at how do we consolidate. One of the things that I've heard loud and clear from the community when we did a survey was to look at our facilities. And so I've said that's fine, but we're going to have a policy. So the board's going to be adopting a school consolidation and facility policy this spring. We haven't had the criteria, which I think is important for our community to have. But, you know, I'm also struck this weekend we opened up a community garden at Tahoe Elementary, a joint use facility. And I hear so much about closing schools, and but, you know, schools can be there and are the center of communities. We just need to figure out how do we repurpose them? How do we open them up to bring the outside in, like in an example that happened at Tahoe? That ought to be happening at all of our facilities, at all of our schools, because they are neighborhood schools. That's an advantage that we have that a lot of other school districts don't.
Deb Sigmund, when a district says this is what we'd like to do, does the department have to sign off on that, or do you just say that's great, just let us know how it goes?
So it is somewhat competitive, and so districts will need to apply on behalf of their schools. We'll receive those applications and review them and look at how effective we think that district has been in designing the model that they need to turn that school around. And then the California State Board of Education will approve those applications. The idea, however, is to fund the applications that come in. So we want folks to be able to write a good application. And so we're providing quite a bit of technical assistance in that regard.
And what will happen to a school that says, this is what we're going to do, to get the money, and it doesn't work?
Well, the grant, what's required is that you implement one of the models. So the expectation is that their reporting requirements. So annually, the school would have to report in terms of its progress. So the expectation is that we will see some improvement. The grant itself doesn't have any sanctions per se, except that the model must be implemented. So we'll obviously be watching that.
And Jonathan Raymond, what happens next with regards to Oak Ridge Elementary and its being on this list, this California Department of Education list?
We're waiting for the RFP to be released by the department. Once we have that, we'll certainly take advantage of our opportunities that will be available to prepare the best and most competitive proposal. Again, we're in the process of talking to staff, talking to members of the community. I'll be meeting with the partners again as I've promised and committed to them, and getting as much input as we can while we make our design and ultimately our application to the department. We think these resources are a good opportunity for us to take advantage, particularly where we're here in California amidst this fiscal crisis, you know, when the state is really disinvesting in education. This is an opportunity to do something, I think, very bold and very needed for this community in Oak Park.
And finally, Jimmy Wilson, how does all this sound to you?
It sounds great. I would love to see a lot more community involvement. We have a huge community that's put their hearts and their efforts into Oak Ridge, and I definitely don't want to see any change in that. So,
well, thank you all so much. We've been talking about California Department of Education's list of 188 persistently lowest achieving schools. That's the official title. And what's going to happen to help those schools succeed in the future. Deb Sigmund is Deputy Superintendent of the Curriculum, Learning and Accountability Branch of the California Department of Education. Jonathan Raymond is Superintendent of the Sacramento City School District. One of the district schools, Oak Ridge Elementary, is on the Department of Education's list. And Jamae Wilson is a tutor and volunteer at Oak Ridge Elementary. She mentors Juliana Fuentes, a sixth grader there. Deb, Jonathan, Jamae, Juliana, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, what's happening at the Sacramento Rail Yards? The developer was months late in paying property taxes. You'll hear from the top local official of Thomas Enterprises. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight at capradio.org/insight. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, a plane crash in Western Russia reopens old wounds and tests a new democracy. And a bloody coup d'etat in another former part of the Soviet Union raises questions about the future of a U.S. airbase in remote Central Asia. That and more on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The developer of downtown Sacramento's old rail yards has faced several recent challenges. Unpaid property taxes on the rail yard site, ongoing arbitration with the city of Sacramento over the disputed value of some rail yard land, and filing for bankruptcy protection in three large projects in other cities. What's going on? Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler spoke with Suhail Tota, the Sacramento-based vice president of rail yard developer Thomas Enterprises.
Sacramento City officials said that Thomas Enterprises hadn't paid taxes from back in December. You made that payment late Friday. Can you explain what happened?
That was a payment that should have been made in December. We became aware of it about a week prior to that. We've taken care of it, both the December payment along with the penalty, as well as the payment that was due in April as well. So all of that has been paid.
Can you explain how an oversight like that could happen?
Well, it was something that our accounting department missed. They run a number of different projects throughout the country and overseas, and those kinds of things do happen from time to time. It's unfortunate, but as soon as we became aware of it, we took care of it and took care of the current bill as well.
How much money were you late on paying, and how much did you pay on Friday?
The late payment was around $100,000, and we paid about $217,000 in total.
So at this point, you're fully good with the city?
Yes, we're fully good with actually it's the county assessor who we paid it to, correct.
There was talk at City Hall on Friday of possibly withholding some of the money that the city is giving you to work on the infrastructure, the roads and track relocation and all of those projects at the rail yards property. Do you view that as being an issue now that you've paid?
I don't think so. I think that's been taken care of at this point.
Were you worried at all on Friday when you had someone coming out, a city council member coming out and saying that?
No, because we had, we intend to pay our bills and did pay it, so I wasn't concerned.
It is springtime, and when the rain stops, that's generally speaking prime construction season. Can you update listeners on a timeline for the infrastructure, the roads, moving the tracks, what you're going to be working on and when it's going to start and when it might finish?
Absolutely. There are a number of projects that will be starting very shortly, the largest of which is the mainline track relocation project. We're expecting that project to break ground in May, so about a month from now, and that'll relocate the mainline tracks from their current location about 400 feet to the north. We will also be constructing an extension on 2nd Street from Old Sacramento to the Central Shop Historic Buildings. That work will be underway in May as well. We will also be building an extension of 5th Street that will come from H Street, where 5th Street currently ends, and it'll come up and over the relocated tracks. That work will be underway either later this month or early May. Also, the extension of 6th Street will be a similar extension up and over the tracks. And then there are some other roads within the site itself, including a street to the north called Rail Yards Boulevard, which will run from 7th Street to Burka and Jaboom Street.
Over by the freeway.
Over by the I-5, correct? Better connections from the I-5 and Richards Boulevard off Burka and Jaboom Street will also be constructed. In addition, regional transit is currently underway with the extension of light rail, what they call the Green Line, which will run from downtown through the rail yards on 7th Street up to Richards Boulevard, where the Township 9 project is being constructed as well.
These are all projects that are being built with public funds, right? Stimulus and state bond funds and so on and so forth, correct?
Yes, these are a combination of state infrastructure funds, federal stimulus funds, Measure A funds. There are also private dollars that are going in from us relating to any of the remediation work related to any of those sites.
Remediation work as in the toxic chemicals that were under the rail yards property back when Union Pacific operated it for decades and decades.
Correct. For example, there are some cleanup that will be necessary under the existing rail tracks that we will be paying for that. We will also be paying for any of the other cleanup that might be required with respect to some of the other roads that are being constructed within the site as well.
What's the timeline for when the projects you spoke of that are about to start, the timeline that they will wrap up?
Those projects will probably be completed sometime in 2012. So it'll be about 2 years from now before you'll be able to actually drive on those roads and be able to access the rail yards from downtown Sacramento.
This is going to be maybe a bit of an obvious question to you, but it's just pouring cement on a road in a currently empty, undeveloped location. How does it take 2 years to build roads?
Well, these are very complex roads. There will be bridges that will be built over the relocated rail tracks. The relocation of the rail tracks itself is a very complicated project. It involves several railroads. And we have to build the new rail tracks and have the rail operators begin operating on the new rail tracks before we can remove the existing rail. And until we remove the existing rail, we cannot connect the streets. So it's not simply building roads out in Natomas or a suburban community. These are major downtown urban roads that will be built along with complex projects such as the track relocation project.
About 3 years ago, the city helped you buy the entire rail yards land by chipping in $55 million for a 30-acre piece of the property. And that money was just a placeholder. You and the city each agreed to get a value on the land and go forth in arbitration to decide what the land is actually worth. But you and the city are $80 million apart. It's $8 million from the city. $88 million is your assessment of what that land is worth. It's now in the hands of an arbitrator. Why do you feel that the 30 acres or so of land where the tracks are going to be moved to, where the transit hub or intermodal, as everyone likes to call it, is going to be located, why do you feel it's worth that much money?
That is something at this point that I cannot comment on. It is in the hands of the arbitrator, and we will be hearing from the arbitrator within the next few weeks, and we look forward to whatever decision the arbitrator makes.
A related question to that is, supposing the arbitrator rules in favor of the city, you would, in theory, Thomas Enterprises would, in theory, owe the city money, which the city has said they would reinvest right back in the rail yards, but how would you pay the city and when?
Well, the agreement provides a mechanism where we would have, I think, till 2012 to pay the city back or to reinvest the money into some of the infrastructure projects we just talked about. And so that would be money that would be funded, funds that would go towards these projects over a period of the next couple of years.
And that's not just any piece of land that you guys are arbitrating. It's the land where the transit hub will be, but also the current proposed site for a new Sacramento Kings basketball arena, or as the mayor likes to call it, an entertainment and sports complex. You also submitted a proposal to locate the arena at the same spot, and you lost out, but you must be feeling like you've kind of won anyway, because the arena is going to, in theory, if everything works out, be on your property, and you don't really have to pour all your time and energy into focusing on it because another developer will.
Absolutely. We think the fact that the site was selected is critical for us and for downtown Sacramento. We think it's the right site. We will benefit definitely at the Rail Yards from having the arena at this location. It'll be a catalyst to help build the various types of retail and entertainment venues that we'd like to see built here at the Rail Yards. And it'll also be a catalyst for downtown Sacramento. By locating it at the front of the Rail Yards, it's really centrally located to become a catalyst for the Rail Yards, but also downtown Sacramento. Within a half-mile radius of the site of the proposed arena, you can access all of the Rail Yards to the north. You can go south to south of Capitol Mall. You can go east to the Convention Center. And you can go well into West Sacramento on the west. So it's a very centrally located facility, which will be a huge catalyst for downtown Sacramento and the region.
One last subject to touch on, and that is the reports both in Sacramento and in Atlanta, where Thomas Enterprises is headquartered, about the financial health of your company in several projects, I think back in the Atlanta area or elsewhere, not the Rail Yards, have defaulted or have really struggled to get off the ground and stalled. What can you tell Sacramento residents and officials about the financial health of this project, the Rail Yards project itself?
The Rail Yards project is quite healthy financially. It's doing very well. We've been fortunate to have the various funds that we've been able to secure from the federal government, from the state, and that has allowed us to move forward with the infrastructure projects. The company as a whole is doing much better as well. The general economic conditions with not only in the United States but internationally appear to be improving, and so things are getting better, and we're very, very much looking forward to a very successful year here at the Rail Yards.
Has there been a point over the last year or two that you were really worried for the health of the Rail Yards? Was there ever a point where things weren't going well in Atlanta and you feared there might be a little bit of a spillover here?
No. You know, we have been very fortunate, as I say, to have really been able to secure the kinds of dollars that we have over the last several years, that we've been a isolated case here, very much different than other projects, not only Thomas projects, but projects throughout the United States. There are very few projects that have been able to secure the type of funds that we have. So we're blessed with that. We've been doing quite well over the last year with the work that we've been doing. We've done quite a bit of work within the central shop buildings. We've begun some of the initial grading work out at the site. That all began last year and is continuing this year. And we're getting ready to go vertical with the bridges, with the track relocation. So we're really looking forward to a huge year this year at the Rail Yards.
There's no doubt in your mind that the Rail Yards will be built and that Thomas Enterprises will be the developer that built it.
Yes. You know, you have to understand that we are the master developer. We're building the roads. We're building the streets, moving the tracks with our partners at the city. We will be building portions of it, but the majority of the Rail Yards will not be built by Thomas. We'll be built by other developers, local developers, national developers. The arena proposal, for example, is a proposal that two local developers, Jerry Camillus and David Taylor, are working on with the city. That will be a project that will be hopefully built here at the Rail Yards. There will be many other projects like that that will be built by developers from the local area as well as nationally.
Suhail Tota is a vice president for Rail Yards developer Thomas Enterprises. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Suhail Tota spoke with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a young classical quartet playing a benefit concert for Haiti. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Look for Insight on Facebook at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Tomorrow, actress and minister Della Reese, plus singer-songwriter Steve Forbert, well known to many for his 80s hit Romeo's Tune, and the psychedelic-style alternative rock of Solar Powered People. A young local classical music group is giving a benefit concert for Haiti this weekend. It's the Trubeck Quartet, which includes the violinist who won this year's Sacramento Classical Jammies Award for Young Musicians. They're all in our studio. They're going to play an excerpt of a piece that they will be playing at the benefit concert. We'll start with one member, Rachel Beck. Rachel, welcome.
Hi.
Rachel, what do you play?
I play the cello.
You play the cello, and your last name, B-A-E-K, seems to be half of the name of the Trubeck Quartet. Are you a founder of the group?
No, I am not. Actually, there was a coach named Susan Lamb Cook who brought us together during the summer.
Okay. Now, the first half of the name Trubeck Quartet seems to be like the first half of the last name of another member of the group, Ray Anthony Trujillo. Ray Anthony, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Is the name of the group, does it include your name, part of your name, Trujillo?
Yeah, it kind of includes maybe a quarter of my name. I don't know.
Yeah. And you play which instrument?
I play the violin.
You play the violin. And you are the person I referred to who took first place in this year's Classical Jammies. It's the annual music awards and concerts put together by the Sacramento News and Review, and it's for young musicians. And you won that. That must have been quite an exciting evening for you.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. What are your plans musically? Do you plan to use this as a springboard for a musical career, or is this just going to be a hobby?
I plan to use this to go forward in music and be a solo artist and be a musician for my whole life.
Well, good luck to you. The two other members of the Trubeck Quartet are also with us. Nicole Huang. Nicole, welcome.
Hi.
You can feel confident. Okay. What do you play?
I play the violin.
You play the violin. How long have you played with the others?
I think last September. So
it's been a few months, about half a year or so. And Camille Getz.
Hi.
What do you play?
I play the viola.
Yes.
So
you're how long have you been playing as a group?
We've been together since September. Nicole joined a little bit later.
Okay. Rachel, tell us about this benefit concert for Haiti.
At first, we were thinking about spreading our talent throughout the Sacramento area, and then we were just all like, oh, we should play a benefit concert for Haiti because they're in a bit of trouble right now. So we just decided to put this together.
And it's this Saturday evening at the Northminster Presbyterian, and all the proceeds will benefit Haiti. And we're going to hear an excerpt from one of the pieces you're going to play. Ray Anthony, what is the piece that you're going to play an excerpt from?
The piece as a quartet, you're asking?
That you're going to play in our studio right now.
Oh, one of my solo pieces I'm going to play is two movements.
No. What are you in our studio this morning? Which piece are you going to be playing, the group?
Yeah, I'm playing the Pannonia Boundless, an excerpt from there.
Great. Okay, well, why don't you get into your places and we will start to hear it. It's the Trubeck Quartet in our studio, and they're going to play an excerpt from the piece Pannonia Boundless that is going to be part of their benefit concert for Haiti this Saturday evening. And here it goes. Wow, that was Pannonia Boundless, performed live in our studio by the Trubek Quartet. It's a young local classical quartet who are playing a benefit concert for Haiti this Saturday evening at Northminster Presbyterian Church. I was not familiar with that piece, so I had to look it up. And it's a fairly recent piece. It has a sort of old world sound to it, but it was actually written by Alexandra Vrebelov, who was born in 1970 in what was called Yugoslavia. Rachel Beck, why did you all choose this piece?
We really wanted to play a contemporary piece, so we were just looking through our pile of music and we were just all like, oh, this is a piece that's not really known, so we just chose it. Yeah.
And Re-Anthony, is it a hard piece to play?
Well, once after you play it for about a few weeks and then you rehearse and rehearse, then it comes pretty natural. And actually, it may sound familiar because the Kronos Quartet actually played this piece as well.
Yeah, well, that's not bad. Kronos Quartet, Trubek Quartet, you know. Well, congratulations to you all. Good luck with the concert. It's Northminster Presbyterian at 7 on April 17th. Re-Anthony Trujillo, Camille Getz, Nicole Huang, and Rachel Beck. Thanks for joining us in Insight.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento woman is featured in a new StoryCorps book. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us at insight@capradio.org. StoryCorps, the oral history project that provides memorable pieces every Friday on Morning Edition, has a new book coming out. It's called Mom, and it features, of course, stories about mothers. A Sacramento woman is one of the people who tell a story in the book, and you'll meet her in a few minutes. But first, Dave Isay, the founder and president of StoryCorps, I asked him how many mom stories he had to choose from.
Well, StoryCorps been around for 6.5 years. We've recorded about 30,000 interviews with 60,000 people because most people come in pairs. So since almost everybody will talk about their mom at one point or another in an interview, I guess it was 3 dozen stories out of 30,000 interviews.
Wow. So how did you boil all the stories down to a few dozen? How did you set about doing that?
There are facilitators. I mean, it's not easy. There are facilitators in the booth for every interview that's done as part of StoryCorps, and part of what they do is suggest stories that might be appropriate for broadcast or for books. So there were probably 1,000 stories that were transcribed, and then a team of people read through those stories and started to cull the ones down that were in some ways the most universal. What this book shows is that no matter where you live or whether you have one kid or 15, whether you're poor or rich, no matter what your race, ethnicity, whether you're a working mom or a stay-at-home mom, that moms share so much in common, their kind of fierce devotion and wisdom and love and courage. So difficult to call down. Every interview that we've done, all 30,000, we think of as equally valuable. I mean, we think of ourselves as a social service, a chance for families to look a loved one in the eye and say how much they mean by listening to their story and then having it preserved at the Library of Congress, this legacy for generations to come. But some stories just rise up. And there's just a power and an eloquence and a poetry to them that just kind of screams off the page, and that's what we put into Mom. It is not a syrupy book.
Were there any stories where you thought, oh my goodness, this is such a great story, but we just don't have room for it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean even, you know, there were many stories like that. I mean, the volume could have been 5 times as big. I mean, there are, for instance, we got, dozens of stories of adopted families. A kid who's tracked down his biological mother, say. Amazing stories, and you end up having to pick one out of several dozen. So it's not easy, but it's really fun to do. And again, I hopefully this book gives us a very authentic picture of what an amazing, tough, and heroic job it is to be a mom.
My guest is Dave Isay, founder and president of StoryCorps. Their new book is called Mom, A Celebration of Mothers from StoryCorps. Did you feel any responsibility to try and have the broadest cross-section of mothers represented, or were you just looking for the most compelling stories?
You know, I think we were looking for the most compelling stories, and they could be nothing else but the broadest cross-section of stories, you know. But because we've done so many stories through StoryCorps, it touches kind of every sort of family, every kind of place in the country you can imagine, and the stories that kind of bubbled up as those that were so powerful happened to come from, you know, every sort of person that you can imagine and every kind of situation you can imagine.
Why did you decide to make a mom-themed book as opposed to, say, a dad-themed or kid-themed or whatever?
Well, dad will probably come at some point in the future. This is our first themed book. We had one other StoryCorps book called Listening is an Act of Love. And, you know, when for the facilitators who've been inside the booth for all of the 30,000 interviews will say that even when someone comes in and they're 80, 90, or 100 years old, the first thing they'll usually start talking about is their parents, and usually it's their moms. And many times they'll start crying telling stories about their moms at 100 years old. So it is our first and often our most profound bond, and it seemed to make sense as a first StoryCorps book.
When people show up at the booth, the mobile or the stationary ones, do you or your staff say, you know, try and look for this kind of story, or does it entirely depend on what they show up wanting to talk about?
Yeah, I'm never at the booth. I'm here in Brooklyn, New York, trying to, you know, raise money for StoryCorps and kind of grow this into a national institution. We are a human service, and people have usually prepared before they come to StoryCorps on our website at StoryCorps.org. We have something called a question generator, which has kind of the 10 most popular questions and hundreds of others. But what the facilitators and people choose those questions before they come to the booth. But what we tell people to do, and what facilitators will tell you when you come to the booth, is to ask those questions you've always wanted to ask. And part of the magic of StoryCorps is that, as you know, the microphone gives you the opportunity and the license to ask questions you've never gotten to ask before, and have conversations you've never gotten to have. You know, in this mom book, there's an interview between a mom and her son. And she's 75 years old, and she had adopted her son. And in the course of the interview, the mom says, "I want you to know that when I was 17 years old, I had a baby and gave that baby up for adoption." And she had never discussed this with her son, who she was very close to, before this interview. So it gives you the chance to not only ask questions you've never asked before, but to kind of, you know, get many people use it as a chance to get closure.
Finally, Dave, when you started StoryCorps in 2003, I think it was, where did you think it would be in 2010?
You know, when StoryCorps started, it was really a day-by-day thing. It was this kind of crazy idea. You put a booth in the middle of Grand Central Terminal, and you throw it open for people to come in and record the stories of their lives. And I was thinking 24 hours ahead and just hoping that it worked, and it has worked. You know, where we are now is that we're looking to touch the lives of every American family with StoryCorps, and I certainly had never expected that when we opened up 6.5 years ago. But every day has been really it's just been such a privilege and a pleasure to wake up and see the impact of this kind of simple act of interviewing and listening to a loved one has on families and how important it becomes to them.
Dave Isay, founder and president of StoryCorps. Their new book is called Mom, A Celebration of Mothers from StoryCorps. It's published on April 15th. Dave Isay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Well, one of the people telling stories in the new StoryCorps book is Annette Zumba, a Sacramento woman, and she joins us. Annette, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you, StoryCorps.
Well, you and your sister, Jen, told a story to StoryCorps about your mother. What is that story?
After my youngest brother, there's 7 kids. We were born in 8.5 years. I'm the oldest. My sister, Jen, is the 6th. Our mother got a calling from God, and she became a nun in the Sisters of Holy Name of Jesus and Mary.
Was that a surprise to you and your siblings?
My mother's a very adventurous person, and she's a very truthful person. And she said that in the middle of the night one evening in Shell Beach, California, she was asleep, and she heard this unworldly voice, and it said, "Jane, you know what I want you to do."
Had she led a religious life up to that point?
We were practicing Catholics, as having 7 kids in 8.5 years, my parents proved. And we left the church during the Vietnam War when we began questioning everything. My mother was an anti-war protester, and she was really looking for solace in the area of getting out of the Vietnam War and being very pro-feminist. It wasn't until many years later that she returned to the church.
Were you all grown up at the time when your mother decided she was going to become a nun?
The youngest child, Joe, and my sister Jen, who we shared the story together, they were 16 and 17, and my mother had to wait until the youngest was 18 before she could take her full-fledged vows.
Because the church wouldn't let her do it until then?
It's just there's very few laws about a mother of seven kids, and they just decided when the youngest one was 18 it would be appropriate.
How did you and your siblings react when your mother told you this?
One of the reasons we set up this interview with StoryCorps is that my experience and my sister's experience was completely different. I'm 5 years older than she is. She was 17. And for her, she was going to have a loss of a home. Where would she go for Christmas? And, you know, who does she call in the middle of the night in case something goes wrong? So for my brother, Joe, and my sister, Jen, there was a feeling of abandonment for a short period of time, whereas the rest of us were saying, oh, that's so Mom.
And how did your mother deal with that, that feeling of abandonment in at least some of her kids?
It was a real struggle for her. She felt as though she had been a bad mother. As a result of that, she had tremendous guilt 20, 30 years later. But the relationship mended relatively quickly.
Annette Zumba is featured in the new StoryCorps book. She lives in Sacramento. The new StoryCorps book is called Mom. It comes out on Thursday. It's a series of stories about mothers. How did it turn out for your mother? I mean, years later, for your mother and for your family, looking back, how did people feel about the decision?
Well, it's a unique story, and when you tell people, they don't believe it. I think that for the family, we learned that it was true for my mom. It was the way she really needed to be. My mother has always taken care of the dying, the sick, and the elderly, and this was a perfect fit for her.
You said that your sister Jan had a harder time with it when your mother made the decision to become a nun. Did her position change over the years?
Yes, it certainly did. And Jen came full circle. My mother raised seven kids pretty much on her own. My father was absent a great deal of the time. And Jen was the one person in the family that wanted to have an open home. She has two adopted children. She takes care of methamphetamine-born babies. She is a natural at nurturing, as my mother was.
Did you and your sister Jen go to the StoryCorps booth to tell this story?
Yes. Yeah. People have encouraged us over the years, and I've been encouraged to write a book about it. It's very difficult when you're going to write about your mom and you want to make sure that everything is perfect. We haven't told our mom about this book. We're sending it to her when it comes out. In fact, we haven't told the other five siblings. We wanted this to be a surprise.
Have you any idea how your mother will react?
She'll probably say, really? Did I do that? She's in her 70s, and sometimes she forgets things. I think what she'll do is appreciate the fact that the youngest and the oldest really care a great deal about her decision.
And how did you and Jen react when you heard from StoryCorps that this story was going to be in the book?
Well, it was just exciting beyond words because a part of us had always wanted a story written about our mom. There's been newspaper articles numerous times in different states. But to be able to be on StoryCorps, I've been a longtime fan of National Public Radio and StoryCorps. I helped to start two NPR stations in California. So the idea of being able to be heard on it was important.
Well, I can imagine. Well, Annette Zumba, she's one of the people telling us stories about mothers in the new StoryCorps book called Mom, which comes out on Thursday. Annette's mother became a nun. She had seven kids. The kids were all more or less grown up when it happened. Annette Zumba, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Jamie Kroll, Mara Ponce, and joining us today, Esteban Hernandez. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer was Nick Bruner. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us.